What Job has been saying is hardly merits the kind of language that Eliphaz uses. Job has been saying, "All the days of my struggle I will wait until my change comes. If a man dies, will he live again?" And he goes on to mourn and say that when, just as water washes away the stones and its torrents wash away the dust of the earth, so man's hope is washed away and destroyed. Now Eliphaz the Temanite responded in chapter 15, "Should a wise man answer with windy knowledge and fill himself with the east wind?" This east wind was a harmful desert wind. It's the kind of wind that brought drought and crop failure. And it was used as a picture of everything that blights and that disappoints people's hopes. Something that is not only barren itself, but creates barrenness. And what he's really saying here is, Job, you've been talking, you're full of blether. You know that Scottish expression? Stop blethering, Job. Should he argue with useless talk or with words which are not profitable? That is pretty severe. He's quite right to say that a wise man should be careful not to argue with useless talk, but to say that Job's talk was useless and his words were not profitable was rather severe. He says in verse 4, "Indeed, you do away with reverence and hinder meditation before God." There was a false accusation. "For your guilt teaches your mouth, and you choose the language of the crafty. Your own mouth condemns you, and not I, and your own lips testify against you." He challenges Job's words. And he says to him in verse 7, "Were you the first man to be born, or were you brought forth before the hills? Do you hear the secret counsel of God and limit wisdom to yourself?" When he speaks about the secret counsel of God, he's obviously referring to something that was known to them. There is, of course, in the will of God, that which is revealed and that which is concealed. In Deuteronomy 29 and verse 29, Moses says, "The secret things belong to the Lord our God." But there's also a psalm which says, "The secret of the Lord is with them that fear him, and he will show them his covenant." That's Psalm 25. And what Eliphaz is saying now is, do you hear the secret counsel of God and limit wisdom to yourself? Do you think you're the only one that is in the secret counsel of God? You know that famous psalm, Psalm 91. "He that dwells in the secret place of the Most High shall abide under the shadow of the Almighty." There's a place where those that are close to God understand things that the world does not. Let's look at that in 1 Corinthians chapter 2. And you'll find it is the prerogative of every believer. And this is why Eliphaz is saying to Job, "Listen, Job, you're not the only one. We're also believers in God. We also share in those things that the world is ignorant of." 1 Corinthians chapter 2. And verse 6. "Yet we do speak wisdom among those who are mature, a wisdom, however, not of this age, nor of the rulers of this age who are passing away. But we speak God's wisdom in a mystery, the hidden wisdom which God predestined before the ages to our glory. The wisdom which none of the rulers of this age has understood, for if they had understood it, they would not have crucified the Lord of glory. But just as it is written, things which eye has not seen and ear has not heard, and which have not entered the heart of man, all that God has prepared for those who love him. For to us God revealed them through the Spirit. For the Spirit searches all things, even the depths of God. And then he says in verse 14, but a natural man does not accept the things of the Spirit of God, for they are foolishness to him, and he cannot understand them, because they are spiritually appraised. Now, what Eliphaz is saying, Job, you have entered into the secret of God. You know the secret counsel of God, but so do we. And he's really taxing Job with trying to appear as though he is the only wise man. Well, just earlier on, Job had been saying to Zophar and his friends, wisdom will die with you. Now Eliphaz is turning the tables on Job and saying, you're talking as though wisdom will die with you. It's just backwards and forwards, retaliation all the time. What do you know that we do not know? What do you understand that we do not? He says, both the gray-haired and the aged are among us, older than your father. So even if we didn't know it, we can go to our elders, and they know, and they would pass it on to us. He also challenged Job. He said, do you have any secret sin? Is that why you're like this? And when he does that, he puts his finger on a very important psychological fact. This is how he puts it. Why does your heart carry you away? And why do your eyes flash that you should turn your spirit against God and allow such words to go out of your mouth? Usually someone under conviction tries to shake off their conviction of sin by attacking God, by turning the spotlight away from themselves where it should be, and then taking it out on someone else or on God himself. That's very common. We have that also. I experienced that last summer. There's someone that was going off at a great rate at this one and the other. Nobody seemed to be right except him. And I told him, I said, you're not right with God. That's your problem. Still hasn't heard the message. But that's the kind of symptom you look for when you notice it. In someone who criticizes everybody, you can be sure that person is out of tune with God. Samuel Rutherford, a great Scottish, great Scottish Christian leader, he said, when men want to find fault with God, they usually begin by finding fault with his people. So there's something to watch for in ourselves and others, and to beware of. And this is what Eliphaz is saying to Job. Why is your heart carrying you away? Why are you turning your spirit against God? In other words, you've got something there's something wrong with you, Job. What is man that he should be pure, or he who is born of a woman that he should be righteous? There is no such thing as a holy, righteous human being in this world. Behold, he puts no trust in his holy ones, and the heavens are not pure in his sight. How much less one who is detestable and corrupt, man who drinks iniquity like water. He doesn't put any trust in his holy ones, and that must refer to angels and others, maybe saints. The Lord Jesus himself did not commit himself to those that believed on him. At the feast day in Jerusalem, they saw the miracles which he did, but he didn't commit himself to them because he didn't need any testimony from men. And also he knew what was in man. He knows that we are fickle creatures. One day we're for him, the other day we're against him. But he says here, the heavens are not pure in his sight, because, as we saw in the scriptures, even the heavens have been defiled because they have been the scene of an angelic rebellion. In Colossians chapter 1, we find that the Lord is coming to reconcile even heaven. Colossians Colossians 1, verses 19 and 20. For it was the Father's good pleasure for all the fullness to dwell in him, and through him to reconcile all things to himself, having made peace through the blood of his cross. Through him, I say, whether things on earth or things in heaven. We think of heaven as an unsullied place, but it has witnessed a terrible fall, the fall of Lucifer and his hosts. And those angels that did not fall, didn't fall because they were held from falling, not because of any inherent goodness in themselves. God kept them from falling. They are called the elect angels. So we find that the Lord is going to cleanse heaven itself through his sacrifice, as well as bring peace on earth. Glory to God in the highest, and on earth peace, goodwill towards men. Interesting, isn't it, that the taint of sin reaches much further than we think. Now Eliphaz continues by saying, I will tell you, listen to me, and what I have seen, I will also declare. What wise men have told and have not concealed from their fathers, to whom alone the land was given, and no alien passed among them. He's referring perhaps to those that were the descendants of Noah, because he says about them that to whom alone the land was given. It looks as though there were very few inhabitants of the earth at that time. And these passed down their wisdom and their revelation and their information. And he says, all of them with one voice have transmitted these facts. One is, the wicked man writhes in pain all his days, and numbered are the years stored up for the ruthless. It's true that Enoch prophesied about God's judgment on the ungodly, and we find also that the descendants of Noah also proclaimed the same message, that there is no future for the ungodly and for the wicked. Verse 21, sounds of terror are in his ears. While at peace, the destroyer comes upon him. Verse 24, distress and anguish terrify him. They overpower him like a king ready for the attack, because he has stretched out his hand against God and conducts himself arrogantly against the Almighty. Here is someone that dares to defy God, and who even seeks to engage God in battle. He rushes headlong at him with his massive shield. But, verse 29 and 30, he will not become rich, nor will his wealth endure, and his grain will not bend down to the ground. When grain is ripe, the ears bend over from the very weight of the corn in them. But he says, no, the wicked man will never prosper. He will not escape from darkness. The flame will wither his shoots, and by the breath of his mouth he will go away. That is, by the breath of God's mouth he will vanish. The same is said about the coming of the Lord, that he's going to consume Antichrist with the breath of his mouth. Isaiah speaks about the coming Savior in chapter 11, with the breath of his mouth he shall slay the wicked. It's a well-known picture. Verse 33, he will drop off his unripe grape like the vine, and will cast off his flower like the olive tree. For the company of the godless is barren, and fire consumes the tents of the corrupt. Well, there you are. He is describing the fate of a wicked man. Generally, that was true. Not in every case, as Job was about to point out to him. No, says Job, you can't talk like that. There are cases where the wicked prosper and the righteous suffer. Solomon says in the book of Ecclesiastes, I have seen princes walking on the earth, and I have seen servants riding on horses. Things sometimes are topsy-turvy in this world of sin. But by and large, this was true. And Eliphaz was right in what he said. The unfortunate thing is, he was hinting that this is what was happening to Job. Because Job had lost everything. His wealth had not endured. He had lost all his livestock. He'd lost his family. And so Job in chapter 16 says, I have heard many such things. Sorry comforters are you all. Have you come to comfort me? Well, you are not doing it. That's what he's saying here. Is there no limit to windy words? You say that I am speaking words like a strong wind, but you are the ones that are guilty of this. Or what plagues you that you answer? I too could speak like you if I were in your place. I could compose words against you and shake my head at you. If I was in your place, said Job, I could do the same that you're doing to me, but I wouldn't do it. He says in verse 5, I could strengthen you with my mouth, and the solace of my lips could lessen your pain. Job wants to point out that that's what they should be doing for him. That when they see his pain, they should lay aside any accusations, however justified they might be. The time may come when they could tell him where he'd gone wrong, but right now he needed something to steady him. Verse 6, if I speak, my pain is not lessened, and if I hold back, what has left me? But now he has exhausted me. Thou hast laid waste all my company. He's talking about God now. He says, all my company, all my family, all my retinue, they have been laid waste. He speaks about his leanness in verse 8. My leanness rises up against me. It testifies to my face. And then in the following verses, he describes his pitiful condition in very vivid language. The way he speaks about his condition is a pretty accurate description of what the Lord could have said when he was on the cross. Look at what he says here. Verse 9, his anger has torn me and hunted me down. He has gnashed at me with his teeth. My adversary glares at me. They have gaped at me with their mouth. They have slapped me on the cheek with contempt. They have massed themselves against me. God hands me over to ruffians and tosses me into the hands of the wicked. I was at ease, but he shattered me. And he has grasped me by the neck and shaken me to pieces. He has also set me up as his target. His arrows surround me. Without mercy, he splits my kidneys open. He pours out my gall on the ground. He breaks through me with breach after breach. He runs at me like a warrior. I have sewed sackcloth over my skin and thrust my horn in the dust. The horn there was a symbol of power. It says, now there's no power left for me. My flesh is flushed with weeping, and deep darkness is on my eyelids, although there is no violence in my hands, and my prayer is pure. There's a very vivid description of his sufferings, and it's also a vivid description of Calvary, of what the Lord endured. He then calls to heaven and earth to maintain his right and to echo his cry for justice. O earth, do not cover my blood, and let there be no place for my cry. Even now, behold, my witness is in heaven, and my advocate is on high. He's already beginning now to speak about his Redeemer. And he says, I know that I've got an advocate. Earlier on, remember, he said, I wish I had an umpire. There isn't someone. Now, his faith is rising. And he's saying, no, my witness is in heaven. My advocate is on high. I do have someone on my side who's ready to plead my cause for me. my lawyer, if you like, my counsel for the defense. He's beginning now to show more faith and more hope. His friends are slapping him down, but every time he responds to their challenges and to their accusations, his faith is rising. My friends are my scoffers. My eye weeps to God. In verse 21, he says, "Oh, that a man might plead with God as a man with his neighbor." He's longing for that mediator. And yet, already he's thrown out the hint. He knows he has one. In chapter 17, he says, "My spirit is broken. My days are extinguished. The grave is ready for me." And going on in verse 3, he spoke to God and said, "Lay down now a pledge for me with thyself. Who is there that will be my guarantor?" Let's make a pledge together. Let's come together and debate this whole situation, my whole predicament. Who is there that will be my guarantor? I need a guarantor. That guarantor that he speaks about, who is there that will be my guarantor, that is answered in Hebrews. In Hebrews chapter 7, we find that that guarantor that Job wanted so much is none other than the Lord. Chapter 7, and I have to read from verse 18. "For on the one hand, there is a setting aside of a former commandment because of its weakness and uselessness, for the law made nothing perfect. And on the other hand, there is the bringing in of a better hope through which we draw near to God. And inasmuch as it was not without an oath," and then verse 22 picks it up again after the parenthesis, "so much the more also Jesus has become the guarantee of a better covenant." He is the guarantor of better things. The surety. That's how it is in the Authorized Version. "Who is there that will be my guarantor?" That's Job's question. And God's answer to Job is, Jesus is your guarantor. He says, "I need to speak to God. I've tried to speak to my friends, but they are so foolish, they are so scatterbrained, I can't get anywhere with them." Verse 4, "For thou hast kept their heart from understanding, therefore thou wilt not exalt them. He who informs against friends for a share of the spoil, the eyes of his children also shall languish." Flatterers. His friends were devoid of understanding, and they were informing against him, in a sense. That's how he understood their attitude towards him, accusing him. The rest of this chapter, in chapter 17, he laments the fact that he is so degraded now. "But he has made me a byword of the people, and I am one at whom men spit. My eye has also grown dim because of grief, and all my members are as a shadow." And then he says, "The upright shall be appalled at this, and the innocent shall stir up himself against the godless. Nevertheless, the righteous shall hold to his way, and he who has clean hands shall grow stronger and stronger." When they see how he has been standing, he's a little bit self-righteous here. He's saying, when the innocent and the righteous see how I'm standing steadfastly for what is right, even though I'm being deterred by people who are professing to comfort me and who are accusing me falsely, when they see this, they too will gain courage to stand for what is right, as I am doing. It won't deter them. It'll just encourage them to come alongside the underdog and to maintain the cause of justice, because right now it's in danger of being swamped by lying words and flatteries and false accusations. Then he turns around to them and he says, verse 10, "But come again, all of you now, for I do not find a wise man among you." Well, he says in verse 15, "Where is now my hope, and who regards my hope?" It's interesting to list the questions that Job asks and to find how in every case the answer is to be found in the Lord himself. He says, "Where is now my hope, and who regards my hope?" What is it that I hope for? Well, Jesus is the answer. Because in writing to Timothy, Paul says, "Our Lord Jesus Christ is our hope." He is our hope. And in him is found Job's hope, as he will be saying later on. He's just afraid, though, that his hopes will perish. He says in verse 16, "Will it go down with me to Sheol? Shall we together go down into the dust?" And at this point, Bildad replied. Then Bildad the Shuhite responded, "How long will you hunt for words? Show understanding, and then we can talk. Why are we regarded as beasts, as stupid in your eyes, O you who tear yourself in your anger? For your sake is the earth to be abandoned, or the rock to be moved from its place?" An indignant retort against Job. Then, the same old thing. The same old thing that Eliphaz and Zophar had been saying trots out of Bildad's lips. It's just the same thing over and over again. "Indeed, the light of the wicked goes out, and the flame of his fire gives no light. The light in his tent is darkened, and his lamp goes out above him. His vigorous stride is shortened, and his own scheme brings him down. For he is thrown into the net by his own feet, and he steps on the webbing. A snare seizes him by the heel, and a trap snaps shut on him," etc. All the way down, he describes the fate of the wicked. But he's really doing Job a favor. Because however good Job was, he was always afraid that he wasn't good enough to please God. That he might yet be putting a foot wrong and then bring down God's judgment upon his head. And what Bildad was doing was really just bring to the surface all those hidden fears that Job had carried with him year after year after year. Am I really, Job had been asking himself, am I really the man that I appear to be? Or am I faking it? And now Bildad says, this is what happens to the wicked. That's exactly what Job was afraid of. This is what's going to happen to me if I'm not for real. And Job was compelled to face his fears through the accusations of his friends. Verse 12. "His strength is famished and calamity is ready at his side. His skin is devoured by disease. The firstborn of death devours his limbs." The firstborn of death refers to the eminent, death in its most eminent form. The term in the Hebrew Bible, the firstborn, doesn't necessarily mean every time the one that is born first. It can mean the preeminent one. And in this case, it is death in its preeminent form is devouring his limbs. Well, Job was suffering that. His skin was being devoured by disease. So he was being tormented by his fears that after all these things had happened to him because he was a hypocrite. Because he was not for real. That he had been playing a double game. That he was two-faced. that he was leading a double life. And his friends, in accusing him, make him face this and realize that it is not true about himself and reject it. And in doing so, Job was liberating himself. Verse 19, Bildad says, "He has no offspring or posterity among his people, nor any survivor where he sojourned. Those in the west are appalled at his fate, and those in the east are seized with horror. Surely such are the dwellings of the wicked, and this is the place of him who does not know God." You brought it on yourself, Job. You had it coming to you. That's what Bildad said to Job. Well, in response, Job rose nobly. And we find here that his faith reaches a height that is greater than ever before. He starts by saying in verse 2, "How long will you torment me and crush me with words? These 10 times you have insulted me. You are not ashamed to wrong me." So he's beginning to realize, no, this is not true. You're telling lies about me. He's beginning to realize the truth about himself. He knew it, and yet he doubted it. Now he's beginning to drive away those doubts. "Even if I have truly erred, my error lodges with me. I am the one who's paying for this mistake, not you. If indeed you vaunt yourselves against me and prove my disgrace to me, know then that God has wronged me and has closed his net around me. No, it's not my sins that have overthrown me. God is in this picture somewhere. God has determined to do this to me. Behold," he says, "I cry violence, but I get no answer. I shout for help, but there is no justice. He has walled up my way so that I cannot pass, and he has put darkness on my paths. My sufferings, he has stripped my honor from me and removed the crown from my head." And then from verse 13, he describes the alienation of his own family and of his friends. Verse 13, "He has removed my brothers far from me, and my acquaintances are completely estranged from me." My own brothers are now far from me. My relatives, they are scared to come near me, and my acquaintances are completely estranged from me. The inner circle. My relatives have failed, and my intimate friends have forgotten me. This is the kind of fate that we find in the Psalms as well, in various places. In Psalm 31 is one of the examples where David went through the same kind of anguish. There are some times when the child of God feels completely deserted, completely alone. Psalm 31, David says in verse 11, "Because of all my adversaries, I have become a reproach, especially to my neighbors, and an object of dread to my acquaintances. Those who see me in the street flee from me." There's another one in Psalm 38 and verse 11. "My loved ones and my friends stand aloof from my plague, and my kinsmen stand afar off." It was then not unique to Job, but even the best of God's servants knew what it was to suffer a sense of desertion. Job went on to say in verse 15, "Those who live in my house and my maids consider me a stranger." They were afraid to come near him in case they got overtaken by his calamity. "I am a foreigner in their sight." In verse 16, "I call to my servant, but he does not answer. I have to implore him with my mouth. Usually, servants were summoned by a gesture. In those days, servants weren't usually spoken to by the master, except where it was strictly necessary. Usually just a signal was enough for the servant. A clap of the hand, or some kind of a wave of the hand, or a hand signal. In one of the Psalms, David says, "Behold, as the eyes of the servants look to the hand of the master, of their master, so our eyes are upon the Lord our God." Because from the master comes the signal that they need to know what they're to do next. And so we're looking to God, says David in that Psalm, Psalm 123. Now he says, my servant does not answer. I have to implore him with my mouth. But there's even worse, he says. Verse 17, my breath is offensive to my wife, and I am loathsome to my own brothers. Maybe some of you saw that cartoon in Farside, two dragons. They were in bed, and one of them saying, "I'm sorry, dear, it's your breath. It's so fresh and minty." He turns reality on its head. But in this case, his disease had caused his breath to be offensive and foul. She too was in anguish and repelled by his disease, and it wasn't even garlic. "And I am loathsome to my own brothers." But then he continues with the catalogue. "Even young children despise me. I rise up and they speak against me." Young children here doesn't refer to the very small. We think of young children as preschoolers or in a kindergarten or maybe in the first few grades. But in the Bible language, young children could be early teens. People in their early teens were called young children. In fact, those young men that grew up with Solomon's son, who were about his age, which is 40, are called little children in Hebrew. So it's all relative, isn't it? When he speaks about young children, he probably means then juvenile delinquents here. And he's saying, even young children despise me. I rise up and they speak against me. There was an example of that in the days of Elisha the prophet. He had just seen his master taken up to heaven in a whirlwind. And as he was going up past Bethel, these young people came out, juvenile delinquents, they're called children. They came out of Bethel and they mocked him. And they said, "Why don't you also go up? We don't want you around." That's in effect what they were saying to him. You find that in 2 Kings chapter 2. It's better read than told. 2 Kings chapter 2 and verse 23. 2 Kings chapter 2 verse 23. "Then he went up from there to Bethel. And as he was going up by the way, young lads came out from the city and mocked him. And said to him, 'Go up, you bald head.'" Well, we know then that he didn't have much hair. "When he looked behind him and saw them, he cursed them in the name of the Lord. Then two female bears came out of the woods and tore up 42 lads of their number." They had nowhere to run from those bears. Maybe they tried climbing a tree. But then they were fair game for the bears, because bears can also climb trees. And that was the fate of 42 of them, torn to pieces by two she-bears. They were mocking Elisha. And now Job says here, that's exactly what they're doing to me. I rise up and they speak against me. They shout taunts at me and hurl abuse. It's very sad when it happens with young people. And then verse 19, "All my associates abhor me, and those I love have turned against me. My confidants, my associates, you Eliphaz and Bildad and Zophar, you are my inner circle, and you are also turning against me. It's a terrible predicament to be abandoned by those whom we counted to be our friends. You know, Charles Spurgeon's life was shortened. He was a man that lived at a time when his denomination was beginning to go liberal. And he could see the dangers, and he sounded the warning note. And the result is nearly every minister in his denomination turned against him. There are only perhaps half a dozen that stood by his side, but over 100 turned against him. And he found himself virtually alone, holding the field. He was fighting for the full inspiration of Holy Scripture. That was one of the platforms on which he stood. And all those others were beginning to give way on it because of higher criticism and because of evolution, which were then quite new. And these theories were bowling people over. But Spurgeon stood his ground, not without cost, because he was a sensitive man, and the result is that he died only at 56, which today's reckoned middle age. Well, it's a sad thing, and he says in verse 21, pity me, O you my friends, for the hand of God has struck me. Why do you persecute me as God does, and are not satisfied with my flesh? And now he comes out with these great words. Oh, that my words were written, or that they were inscribed in a book, that with an iron stylus and lead they were engraved in the rock forever. And as for me, I know that my Redeemer lives. Every time his friends come down on him, his faith rises higher, and he becomes bolder in his expressions of faith in God. I know that my Redeemer lives, and at the last he will take his stand on the earth. The word for redeemer is the same as the word for ransomer. When we redeem an article, we pay what we owe on it. Maybe we put a deposit on it and we come to redeem it, and we pay the rest. And that's called redeeming. In the same way, he's talking about his redeemer as one who's coming to pay for him, to purchase him, to pay the price that is necessary in order to buy his freedom and his salvation. I know that my Redeemer lives. This picture of a Redeemer is found throughout the Scriptures. A Redeemer, usually in the Law of Moses, describes a man who has various functions. He is a blood avenger. If any of his relatives has been murdered, it's the Redeemer, who is a near relative, who must go out and avenge that murder. So he's called Goel in Hebrew. That's the Hebrew word for it, Redeemer. Also, if one of his relatives has had to sell his property because he was poor and he needed money, the Redeemer could buy it back and give it back to his poor relative. If a man had to sell himself as a slave because he was too poor to live independently, the Redeemer could buy his freedom. And lastly, if someone had a huge debt that he couldn't pay, he could turn to his Redeemer and ask him to underwrite the debt. So the whole picture is of restoration and of redemption and of release and of retribution. That's what he's saying here. I know that my Redeemer lives. I know that Moses came hundreds of years after Job, but what Moses described in the law was an existing situation. This kind of situation was already well known in Job's day, this kind of culture and these customs. You'd find it in the book of Genesis. Well, he says, "As for me, I know that my Redeemer lives, and at the last he will take his stand on the earth. Even after my skin is flayed, yet without my flesh I shall see God."